Blog Talk Radio.
This is the news in brief from the United Nations. The central Chinese province of Henan, which has been hit by devastating flooding, received more than a year's worth of rain in under a week, UN weather experts said on Wednesday. According to the World Meteorological Organization, WMO, between the 17th and the 21st of July, the National Meteorological Observation Station in Zhengzhou recorded 720 millimeters of rainfall compared to the annual average of 641. More than half of this deluge fell in the space of 6 hours, while more than 200 millimeters fell in the space of just 1 hour. The UN Weather Agency noted that more than 600 stations recorded precipitation over 250 millimeters. The maximum was 728 millimeters. Henan's Meteorological Administration initiated the second highest level emergency response to deal with the flooding. According to reports, more than 10,000 people have been evacuated to shelters in Henan, home to 94 million people. Historic Docklands and buildings in the UK city of Liverpool have been removed from the UN cultural body UNESCO's list of World Heritage Sites, it announced on Wednesday. The move follows concerns raised in 2012 about the proposed development of disused Dockland near the city centre, which a UNESCO committee decided were detrimental to the site's authenticity and integrity. Liverpool was added to the World Heritage List in 2004 in recognition of its role as one of the world's major trading centres in the 18th and 19th centuries, and its pioneering dock technology, transport systems and port management. It is only the third location to lose its World Heritage status after the decision was announced by the UNESCO World Heritage Committee at a virtual conference in China. Media reports have indicated that Liverpool city leaders are disappointed with the news and may consider lodging an appeal. To Tokyo, where the head of the UN World Health Organization, Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus, has welcomed the Olympic and Paralympic Games as a chance to spread hope to the world. More than any other event, the Games have the power to bring the world together, to inspire, to show what is possible, Tedros told the International Olympic Committee with the Olympic flame in his hand. He warned that the world was now in the early stages of another wave of infections and deaths, and he urged all countries to embark on a massive global push to vaccinate at least 10% of their populations by September. Today, 75% of vaccines have been administered in just 10 countries, Tedros said, while in low-income countries, only 1% of people have received at least one dose. The development comes as the WHO reported a 12% increase in global new cases last week compared to the previous 7 days, with over 3.4 million new cases. Since the start of the pandemic 19 months ago, there have been more than 190 million confirmed infections and more than 4 million deaths. Daniel Johnson, UN News.
This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we discuss the case of whistleblower Daniel Hale. He shared documents about the U.S. government's covert drone warfare program with The Intercept. Now, he faces up to a decade in prison. We'll also hear a rebroadcast of our interview with David Rokaw of the ACLU. He told us about Baltimore, Maryland's Aerial Surveillance Research Project, where a plane watched and recorded the movements of all city residents. Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian.
In 2019, the Department of Justice indicted Daniel Hale for giving classified national defense information to Jeremy Scahill for the online publication The Intercept. Hale was a former intelligence analyst for the U.S. Air Force and the NSA. The events in question took place between 2013 and 2015. In late March, Hale pleaded guilty to one count of violating the Espionage Act, punishable by up to 10 years in prison. He's scheduled to be sentenced by U.S. District Judge Liam O'Grady on July 27. Hale was named as the source of several documents that revealed grave government wrongdoing. Much of it related to the Obama administration's expansion of the drone war and other counterterrorism programs that lacked adequate oversight and have brought about as yet unknown numbers of civilian deaths abroad. One document published in The Intercept in 2014 revealed that most of the individuals in the government's terror suspect database had actually no affiliation with any terror group. Many have criticized The Intercept for its failure of source protection. As Law and Disorder recently covered in an interview with Reality Winner's attorney, The Intercept's lapses resulted in her identifying information being shared by The Intercept with the government. Joining us today is William Nyhessel, civil liberties and human rights advocate at the Whistleblower and Source Protection Program, WSPR, at Expose Facts, which has represented some of the most important whistleblowers of our time. William, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you so much for having me.
In his former role as a signals analyst, how was Daniel involved in identifying targets for the U.S. drone program?
Daniel's role was to analyze communications and intercepts. He studied networks of suspected terrorists to connect cells in the network, to identify them, to find them, what they call fix and finish, which is the assassination itself, and then the exploitation of intelligence to identify further targets.
And why did Daniel decide to blow the whistle on the U.S. Covert drone program?
Daniel is one of the most conscientious and principled people I've ever met, and so I think that he was really deeply disturbed by the problems that he saw in these policies and the systems behind them, and how the public was being deceived and kept in the dark, and how they actually operated. I think that he hoped President Obama would do better and realized that he wasn't living up to those promises of transparency and human rights.
Give us some examples of what Daniel's whistleblowing revealed about the program. For example, tell us about the kill chain.
Daniel revealed that these programs were more lethal and less precise than what had been presented publicly by the administration, by multiple administrations, in fact. The documents that he was prosecuted over entailed watchlisting documents, which showed the kinds of information that the government collects on people and how it processes them into these various databases that feed into the terrorist watch lists. They involved a couple of operational case studies of surveillance and assassination operations in Afghanistan, Yemen, and Somalia. And they showed for the first time the details of the kill chain, so-called, which is the sort of bureaucratic and chain of command up through the military into the White House. It was instituted to sort of, it was meant to reassure the public about checks on these systems, but the public really never had any real details on what that looked like and how it worked and how those decisions were made. And so effectively, the president gives 60-day authorization to kill someone. The operational details of the actual strike will be approved at lower levels, but he signs off on the authorization to target that specific person.
I've seen this in a movie, and I read that, according to some of the documents he revealed, potential targets are made into baseball cards that are given to the president, who then has the option of signing essentially their death warrants.
They're referred to as baseball cards, but in reality, it's a PowerPoint slide. I guess the audience can decide which is worse. But it's a single slide that includes the sort of basic demographic information, a simple sort of synopsis, a couple sentences long about why they're targeting this person and what their objective is in taking them out, and maybe a little map that shows the sort of geographical region they're operating in, and the kinds of just a basic overview of the what they call the derogatory reporting, the sort of basic intelligence they have that is leading them to want to target this person. And that slide is what the sort of the higher level officials in the kill chain will review. And one of the really troubling things is that they're looking at it at a very high level, and so these analysts who sort of create this package that they're sending up the kill chain, they have a ton of power, really. It's godlike power to decide who lives and dies, because these higher-level officials, they're not really deconstructing and sort of taking apart what's already baked into this, these baseball cards. And so there may be, systematic errors that are creeping in or human errors that are creeping in that are not necessarily analyzed up the chain.
Daniel has said that even though we use the term, quote, targeted killings, during 1 5-month period, more than 90% of those people killed by U.S. airstrikes were actually not the intended targets. And what you just described about that process is pretty horrifying, but equally troublesome is the fact that the government apparently still labeled the people they killed as, quote, enemies killed in action. Has any government official responded to this information to either deny or confirm it?
Not that I'm aware of. Generally, their official policy is not to comment on leaked documents, or what they call stolen documents. And, as you say, the study that was leaked showed that they had been misrepresenting this to the public. And through most of the history of drone strikes, the government never really even counted civilian casualties. So these promises of precision were sort of meaningless until we got this information from a whistleblower.
William, Daniel is the third intercept source to be charged for whistleblowing after reality winner and Terry Albury, whose identities were not fully protected by the online source. What do you think this says about the intercept source protection?
It's certainly not a good look. Reality Winner's case in particular involved very, very basic mistakes that should have been obvious to a veteran journalist and to an organization with the resources and the expertise in how to do better. And troublingly, the way that they handled it was certainly questionable. There's a lot of good journalists there, a lot of people that we have worked with and that I know would fight to protect sources. But we really, at an organizational level, they really seem to have some problems there, and we need better from them.
What are the arguments that Daniel's defense attorneys make in his defense?
Well, to zoom out for a second, these cases have become sort of scripted in a sense because courts have insulated the Espionage Act from its really obvious First Amendment problems. But the defense in these cases will still make a number of arguments to sort of preserve them for appeal, even though they've sort of repeatedly been rejected by these lower courts. But the constitutional issues have not been tested to some degree at higher courts and the Supreme Court. And so the arguments, the briefings that they filed challenging this prosecution involve the issues of selective prosecution, that the government doesn't use this Espionage Act, this 1917 law that was designed supposedly for saboteurs and spies. They don't use it against all leaks and all leakers. They use it against leaks that embarrass them and that they don't want out in the public. And they haven't, for example, when General Petraeus was caught leaking classified information for, honestly, of questionable public interest, they miraculously found a way to charge him with other laws and give him a sort of slap on the wrist. But if a lower-level employee leaks a single document, they're faced with charges of the Espionage Act, even though it's in the public interest. So there's the selective prosecution issue. There's the argument that the Espionage Act itself is constitutionally flawed, that it's overbroad, and that it's written in a vague manner constitutionally, that it criminalizes things that Congress didn't intend to criminalize, but also that the Constitution forbids Congress from criminalizing. And so they challenge it on First Amendment grounds. The government, of course, argues that employees of the government sign away their First Amendment rights when they take a classified job. Now, when they start these jobs, they're required to sign this form. I believe it's standard form 312, that there's a little box that you check that says, I acknowledge that any release of classified information could gravely damage the national security of the United States. And because they've checked that box, that satisfies the culpability requirement under the Espionage Act. They don't have to intend to harm the national security of the United States. They don't have to even actually harm the national security. They just have to be aware that that release could, in theory, harm national security under the law. And so these are the kind of challenges that are filed that courts have been rejected in almost every case. And it leads to certain, sort of absurd situations in court where, you know, under the statute, because of theft of government property, they have to meet a dollar value. Well, the government argued that, right, how do you value classified information? It's this kind of weird capitalist logic that, you know, you have in the whistleblower cases, because in a spy, you could say, okay, well, it's worth whatever the Russians paid for it. But for a whistleblower, how do you value that? Well, they argued that the book sales of the book that was based on these documents met that threshold, which is a ridiculous argument because it argues that anyone who was buying that book was paying it to get access to the documents, even though they were freely available on the Intercept website, for example.
I understand that the Reporters Committee for Freedom of the Press filed a brief on Daniel's behalf. What was the crux of that? Was it a First Amendment argument?
Exactly. They called for dismissal of the case on First Amendment grounds. They presented indicators that this really has become a chill to national security reporting. In one of the early cases that set this precedent, the court sort of bought this argument that they could make that trade-off, that they could, you know, require that government employees were not able to disclose class information because of the agreement they signed, that there's a high, different standard for those people, and that it wouldn't chill national security journalism. But the Reporters Committee presented an argument that it was, in fact, because of the massive increase of these prosecutions and the massive increase in punishments being given, that it was creating a different environment. And they noted that drone warfare is of particularly high public interest.
What connection do you see between Daniel's case and that of another that we've been following closely, namely Julian Assange's?
Well, both of them criminalize the ability to publish and get out to the American people classified information, but true information about what our government is doing in these cases of life and death and war and human rights and civil liberties.
When you were speaking before about the nature of this kind of prosecution, we know that the power of the state makes it very difficult to mount a fair trial for people like Daniel, Reality Winner, and others. So they often plead guilty. Now, Daniel pleaded guilty to one count of unlawful retention and transmission of national defense information. But the government brought four other charges, and am I correct, they've not yet been dismissed?
That's right. I was at that hearing, and I was a little shocked when I heard that the government was not dropping the charges, which is what usually happens in a pleading. They agree not to bring the other charges. But in this case, they've only agreed to put those charges in what's called abeyance, meaning in theory they could still bring those to trial. It's certainly concerning, but we believe that given how sentencing works, the government would not be able to achieve extra prison time by bringing those charges forward. So in theory, at least, we hope that this should be the resolution of this case.
Let's look at another alternative, though. What do we know about the sentencing judge, and what if he's extremely lenient? Do you think that could happen? And if it does happen, then do you think the government could seek a trial on those other charges?
That's certainly the fear, is that if they don't get the sentence that they want, that they could bring those forward. So this, the plea that Daniel's lawyers arranged for him was, we think, probably the least bad option in this case, and we're hoping that he gets a fair sentence and that this is the resolution, that Daniel can move on and move forward with his life.
Years ago, we covered very closely the case of attorney Lynn Stewart. John Ashcroft had even gone on the David Letterman show to announce their prosecution of her. When Judge Kodal in that case pronounced a sentence that we thought was fair,
but that the government was disappointed with because it wasn't long enough, they came back with a superseding indictment. I really hope that doesn't happen in Daniel's case.
It certainly can't be ruled out, just given the sort of intensity with which the government has been persecuting whistleblowers and their desire to really sort of bring the hammer down in these cases. And we see that again with the, you know, with the Assange indictment, that they're willing to risk the free speech issues with, and you know, press freedom issues by prosecuting someone who's a publisher.
William, tell us about Whisper, please, and the kinds of cases that you take on.
Whisper was founded by Jesselyn Radak and Kathleen McClellan, who are sort of preeminent whistleblower attorneys. And Jess herself was a whistleblower very early in the war on terror. She was working at the Department of Justice when we had invaded Afghanistan and captured who they referred to as the American Taliban. It was an American citizen who, before 9/11, had gone to fight with the Taliban and who, you know, was captured and sort of presented as a high-value terrorist by the Bush administration, that they were mining all sorts of intelligence from him. But in reality, they were torturing him, and they were withholding, you know, access to a lawyer. And so she blew the whistle on that, and given her treatment and the experience that she had being retaliated against because of that, she went on to devote her career to defending whistleblowers. So we represent whistleblowers in the national security and human rights arena, people coming out of intelligence agencies or the military who are blowing the whistle on matters of grave concern to, you know, whether it be torture, surveillance, drone strikes, war crimes, and we help them get fair representation because the full power of the government is arrayed against you, and you know, when you face an Espionage Act charge, it's extremely expensive to defend yourself against. It can easily cost more than $1 million just to get to trial. So we provide pro bono representation for those people. We've represented Edward Snowden, Thomas Drake, the NSA whistleblower who was trying to raise, you know, issues of surveillance, John Kiriakou, who revealed the torture program, who challenged the Bush administration's claim that they didn't torture, as well as a number of other whistleblowers, including numerous veterans in the drone warfare program, some of which, by the way, who have only come out simply not to reveal classified information, but to simply talk about their experiences with PTSD and moral injury and their struggle to get treatment for those.
Several years ago, we interviewed the filmmaker of The Good American, which focused on Bill Binney and his colleagues, including Thomas Drake, about the Thin Thread program that would have saved a lot of money and also protected Americans' privacy in efforts to root out terrorism. And the damage the government does to these really courageous whistleblowers, the personal toll it takes is discouraging to others who may want to come forward.
Exactly. I mean, the price that's paid is extraordinary. The lengths to which the government will go to ruin you personally, professionally, financially, is simply extraordinary. And you know, it's become a very big chill on national security reporting.
We have a few minutes remaining. Tell us, how is Daniel doing personally right now in the midst of all of this uncertainty?
Daniel has really struggled. You know, he faces issues of PTSD and moral injury. If people are familiar, moral injury is the term that started being used after the Vietnam War, I think, increasingly, as service members, you know, separate from the experience of PTSD being the sort of the traumatic experience just of being in combat or, you know, explosions and gunfire, but moral injury being the sort of the knowledge and understanding that what you're participating in is wrong and in a really fundamental way. And so Daniel has really struggled with those issues, especially as he's been sort of waiting under the sword of Damocles of this indictment to come for, you know, at the time it was 5 years before they indicted him. And, you know, thankfully he was originally out on pretrial, but the government suddenly and unexpectedly arrested him on supposed bail violations. And we never got clarity on what those were. It was never stated in open court, you know, what the supposed reasons for the bail violations were. And he was initially put in administrative segregation, what are really conditions of essentially solitary confinement for 23 hours a day. And that was done supposedly, you know, claimed to be out of concern for his mental health. But, of course, that really exacerbated the issues that, you know, he struggles with. And so, you know, he's still at the local county jail where, you know, as bad as federal prison is, at least when he's transferred to federal prison, he'll have access to more support and programs and recreation opportunities that just don't exist at the county jail, especially during COVID times. And I will also say that, you know, he's finally been able to receive mail there, and that's really his lifeline, and that means a lot. So I really encourage people to write to Daniel and to express support.
Before we let you go, let's just circle back to some of the revelations about the watch list that Daniel helped expose. Can you add any additional information our listeners may be interested in about that?
Yeah, I think that's really important because, you know, we sort of, as shorthand, we often refer to Daniel as a drone whistleblower, but really he's talking about surveillance also. And, you know, these watch listing systems that he revealed, as part of these documents, the public learned that as many as, you know, 50% of the people in the database have no known connection to any terrorist groups. But the public never got any information about, you know, who's on these lists, how did they get on the list, how do you get off of it, can you get off of it? And the Center for American Islamic Relations just filed a brief for Daniel's sentencing arguing that because of these revelations, they were able to get several of their clients off of these watch lists. And some of these are Muslim Americans who were really intimidated by the FBI in many cases to become informants, saying, you know, if you rat out your neighbors or your community, we can help you get off the watch list. And if you don't talk to us, you might not get off of the watch list. And so with this information and these revelations, they were able to file, you know, more targeted lawsuits and legal actions to actually protect their clients' constitutional rights.
Daniel's clearly pulled back the curtain on the wide range of covert and often unlawful actions the government takes in the name of so-called national security. I guess I wanted to ask one final question. Do you have any hope that the landscape for whistleblowers may soften in terms of prosecutions during the Biden administration?
I have hope. You know, the administration has come in and taken a number of actions, I think, that are laudatory. They've, for example, they've, you know, instituted a review on drone strikes and foreign policy in many cases and sanctions. So I think that there's some hope that, you know, they may be finally seeing the necessity of doing that. However, you know, this is President Biden, who was part of the Obama administration, and his government is staffed by many former people who were involved in cracking down on whistleblowing and leaks. And so it really, you know, it could go either way at this point, but we'll see.
Our time has come to an end. Please tell our listeners where they can go to find Daniel's mailing address so they can write to him and also learn more about Whisper's excellent work.
For the latest information and instructions on how to help Daniel, you can go to standwithdanielhale.org. And to learn more about Whisper, you can go to whisper.exposefacts.org.
William, it's really been a pleasure to learn more about this case, your work at Whisper, and we're going to wish all the best for Daniel at his upcoming sentencing, and Law and Disorder will be sure to follow this case as it unfolds. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me, and thank you for bringing attention to one of the most important human rights and press freedom cases of our era.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org. The nation erupts in protests against racially infused police violence. The Baltimore Police Department has just launched a six-month daytime aerial surveillance experiment. A Texas billionaire has funded the project that's being operated by an Ohio-based company, Persistent Surveillance Systems. Airplanes fly overhead and record the movements of nearly everyone in the city. Michael Harrison, Baltimore's police commissioner, justified the nearly $4 million experiment by saying, quote, "There is no expectation of privacy on a public street." He clarified that the airplanes will not film while individuals are inside their homes. The Aerial Investigation Research Pilot Program, as it's called, is by contract limited to monitoring such felony crimes as robberies, carjackings, shootings, and homicides. In theory, the images recorded are to be used only in criminal investigations and will be stored for 45 days. A first prong of the program was conducted covertly in 2016 under a different police commissioner. The ACLU of Maryland calls this initiative the most comprehensive surveillance of a U.S. city in history. ACLU senior staff attorney David Rocha likens it to having a police officer follow you every time you walk out of the door. David joins us today with an update on this aerial surveillance program. He worked on a number of significant cases involving free speech, police misconduct, privacy, election law, and more. In 2011, David was an inaugural recipient of the James Baldwin Medal for Civil Rights. Previously, he worked as a senior trial attorney in the Civil Rights Division at the U.S. Department of Justice, where he focused on police misconduct and conditions in prisons, jails, and other state institutions. David Rocha, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you so much for having me on.
David, in April, a federal court decision allowed an aerial surveillance program to move forward in Baltimore. But this isn't the first time Baltimore has had such a program. When was the first, and what, if anything, is different about this one?
This was originally rolled out in Baltimore in secret in 2016, so secret that at the time it was secret from the state's attorney's office, the mayor, the city council, the Office of the Public Defender, the Criminal Defense Bar, the entire city of Baltimore. The only people who knew it was happening then were the Baltimore Police Department and Ross McNutt, the owner of Persistent Surveillance Systems, the company that has developed this technology and has been looking to deploy it in the United States. When the secret use of this persistent aerial surveillance was disclosed in a Bloomberg Businessweek article, there was, unsurprisingly, a huge uproar, and it was shut down. And since then, Ross McNutt has been trying mightily to convince Baltimore and other cities to use his persistent surveillance technology. And sadly and pathetically, Baltimore decided to become the guinea pig, or I should say, the mayor and police commissioner decided that Baltimore should become the guinea pig for this technology in December of last year, and it was deployed, or it was planned to be deployed starting in April. We sued to block the use of this persistent wide area surveillance of the entire city, but sadly, as you noted, the U.S. District Court here declined to grant a preliminary injunction against it, and that is now on appeal to the Court of Appeals.
Now, who actually funded this pilot program? I understand it's a Texas billionaire. Is that the owner of persistent surveillance?
No. The Texas billionaires are the Arnolds, and they are funding, to the tune of about $3 million, the six-month so-called pilot of this technology here. Ross McNutt is the owner and founder of Persistent Surveillance Systems, the company that markets this surveillance technology. He developed it when he was in the military for use in the Iraq War as a way of attempting to track insurgents who were planting improvised explosive devices. And then when he came back home, saw an opportunity to try to market the technology to law enforcement as a crime-fighting tool.
Why not a drone? I was surprised to hear the technology was being used in an airplane since they're so much more expensive.
Right. I think that's because there are still limits on flying large drones in U.S. airspace, or non-military drones, that is. But if the surveillance technology is allowed to go forward, that is obviously the next step in order to try to bring costs down, because obviously drones can be flown far less expensively than crewed Cessna aircraft, which is where the cameras are, how the cameras are currently deployed.
Now, because airplanes and drones can remain airborne for protracted periods of time, unlike still cameras, they can capture continuous records of an individual's activities. The mayor has said that no one has an expectation of privacy in public places, but how does protracted surveillance reconcile with the Fourth Amendment?
You're right. This technology is categorically different from the ground-based surveillance cameras or one-time flyovers that we are more familiar with in this country. And this technology is the most far-reaching surveillance system ever deployed on American soil. It's important to understand how it works and what it does. So it uses a network of very sophisticated wide-angle cameras which capture in each frame one-third of the city. But the resolution of these networked cameras is sufficient to be able to zoom in and distinguish one person from another. And the cameras record video at the rate of one frame per second, thus creating a slow frame rate video record of everywhere that everybody in Baltimore goes anytime they're outside while the planes are flying. And the planes fly about 12 hours a day. The plan in the current contract is to have three planes in the air at a time, covering more than 90% of the land area of Baltimore. And the net result is a virtual time machine, allowing the police to go to any location and any time, and then trace the movements of every person to and from that location. And the identification, so what the proponents of this, what Ross McNutt and the police commissioner are fond of saying, is that the cameras can't identify anyone, which is the kind of truthy but deeply misleading statement that really hides what's going on here. So it is true that in a single frame of the video footage, because of the resolution and because of the angle of the videography, you can't look at a single frame and know who the person, who any of the dots, any of the people photographed are. But it's worth remembering that this technology was developed for one and only one reason and is being deployed for one and only one reason, and that is to identify people. And it does that in multiple ways. So first, simply by tracing where someone comes from and goes to, that is often sufficient to identify who that quote-unquote dot is. In Baltimore, 75% of the population lives in a single-family house. And so if you know where they leave in the morning and where they go to at night, you can pretty reliably identify them. But identification also works in other ways by being linked to the city's network of ground-based video surveillance cameras so that they will know precisely at what time the person they're tracking has moved past a particular camera, and they can then grab a video image of the person that they're interested in. It's also linked to the city's network of automated license plate readers, which track and identify vehicles, and they can also know when the person has passed private video surveillance cameras that individuals have put in businesses or homes to the extent those are registered with the city, and many are. So there's multiple ways in which identification takes place. And in terms of the Fourth Amendment, what PSS and the mayor and the police commissioner have pointed to is a number of Supreme Court cases dating back several decades, which said that aerial observation of public places does not violate the Fourth Amendment, which is true. But as the court itself made clear in those cases, what they were talking about there was static observation of a particular place at a particular time, not the tracking of the movements of an entire city during daylight hours. And as to that, the relevant Supreme Court opinion is the court's most recent decision in the Carpenter case involving law enforcement acquisition of long-term location tracking data, in that case from cellular service providers. And what the court held in that case was because that movement data is so revealing of private details of life, and because the data is available as to almost everyone, since we all carry cell phones, that allowing the warrantless acquisition of that data by the government would so alter the balance of power and privacy and structure of our society that they said that acquisition of that data as to even a single person was a search within the meaning of the Fourth Amendment. And here, of course, we're not talking about the acquisition of long-term location data about one person, but the acquisition of long-term location tracking information about every single person in Baltimore.
This seems to be the perfect case to bring to the Supreme Court for consideration.
Well, I hope it doesn't have to go that far, but this is game-changing technology. No government in the United States has ever had the power to record, store, track, and have at its fingertips the movement data of the entire population. And I think to give the government that power is profoundly dangerous and profoundly invasive of privacy. It's the technological equivalent of having a police officer follow you every time you walk out the door of whatever building you happen to be in. and record where you're going. And if that happened in real life, I think we would all viscerally and clearly understand the privacy implications. And of course, it couldn't happen in real life. It's only because of these sophisticated new technologies that it can happen. You know, because it's being done remotely from an airplane, we don't have the same visceral experience. But the dangers are exactly the same. The dangers are, frankly, worse than when the government acquires the information about a single person through a warrant process. Here, there's no court involved at all, ever. The government simply tracks the movement of everybody all the time to be used whenever it wants, and that's really dangerous. And that's, you know, that's the basis for our challenge, and I hope the courts will see it the same way.
David, do you think that the Baltimore Police Department shares the data they collect from this persistent surveillance systems with the feds?
Nothing would prevent them from doing so. Do I know that they're doing so now? There is no way for me to know. What they've said they're doing now is a six-month trial of the program, and the only policies or privacy protections, if you want to call them that, that exist in a contract between the BPD and persistent surveillance systems, which is completely meaningless because nobody can enforce that other than the BPD or PSS itself, and neither of whom has any actual interest in enforcing it. There's obviously no ability for the public to enforce it, and of course contractual terms can change at will, and nothing would prohibit the BPD from sharing information with any other law enforcement agency, federal or otherwise. So this is literally the privacy nightmare come to life, this kind of all-seeing eye that tracks us everywhere we go outside is what people who are concerned about the rapid development of technology and privacy and limits on government power have been worried about for decades. And here it is, with Baltimore being the guinea pig for the rollout of this technology.
Why do you think Baltimore was picked as the test city, as it were?
Well, I mean, part of it is a function of the fact that the police department in 2016, shockingly, was willing to secretly deploy the technology without telling anybody, which is just such a, sort of appalling and sick statement in and of itself about policing in Baltimore. Baltimore is unique, certainly in Maryland and perhaps in the whole country, in being a city in which the people of Baltimore have no direct control over their police department, because the police department, dating back to the Civil War era, is statutorily declared to be a state entity, with the city solicitor then taking the position that that means that the Baltimore City Council has no authority to legislate about it or regulate it. And so these decisions are made simply by the police commissioner, who is accountable to no one other than the mayor. And so you have a culture of impunity, basically, which is why the Baltimore Police Department is under a consent decree with the Department of Justice from decades of racist and unconstitutional policing. Obviously, Baltimore is not unique in the country in that regard, but in its lack of accountability, I think it is somewhat unique. And so, I think part of it is because Ross McNutt already had a toehold here, and because he was able to, I think, cynically exploit the misery that this city is experiencing with persistently high murder rates, sense of panic about crime. He was able to sell it as, we're desperate, nothing is working, and here's my magic solution.
in our remaining minutes, I wanted to note that when you talked about lack of enforceability, I read that the contract, one of the provisions is that the data is only to be used in conjunction with felony crimes in Baltimore, and also that it is supposed to be deleted in 45 days. But of course, we have no way, as you say, of enforcing that or knowing if it's happening.
Well, it's worse than that. When it was used in secret, PSS has publicly said, once it was disclosed, we're very concerned about privacy. We delete the data after 45 days. That was what they said back in 2016. That turned out to be a bald-faced lie, as was discovered when the public defender sought data related to cases it was working on and found that the data had been kept indefinitely, which was confirmed in a report written by the Police Foundation, which revealed that what really was happening was that after 45 days, it was just being moved to a different server, not deleted. There's something just really sick about the fact that here's a company which deployed this technology in secret, lied to our faces about what it was doing, and yet is given a $3 million contract to do it all over again. It's like giving the keys to your house to the person who just burglarized it. It's just, at some level, utterly incomprehensible, and perhaps only could happen in Baltimore.
David, I was surprised when you just said there are three planes. I thought it was just one plane. I know that some residents of Baltimore have complained about the noise, but is there groundswell, especially as we see what's happening in the streets with racialized police murders and activism calling for changes? What do residents say about these planes?
There's obviously, unsurprisingly, a mix of opinion in Baltimore. There are many people who are deeply opposed to this. There are some people who are so focused on crime and the police department's inability to make a dent in the murder rate that they think this is the appropriate solution. There's certainly many people who think that the way we should be approaching our crime problem in Baltimore, not just with respect to murder, but more generally, is to focus on more proven strategies and community-based solutions like the Safe Streets programs, which employs violence interrupters to be out in the community and seeking to diffuse conflicts before they get to the level of shootings, and which where they've been deployed have been quite successful, but they're not getting $3 million grants from the Arnolds or anyone else, and there's something really warped and wrong about that. So there is certainly plenty of people who are deeply concerned about it, and the person who just won the mayoral primary, the Democratic mayoral primary here in Baltimore, Brandon Scott, is someone who has been an opponent of using this kind of technology and persistent surveillance. So that's a good sign. I think there were a number of mayoral candidates who were outspoken proponents of this, all of whom were far back in the field. So I think that says something about the level of public support for this in Baltimore.
And what, if anything, is the ACLU doing in terms of a next step about this?
Yeah, so as I said, we filed suit to block it. We were unsuccessful in getting a preliminary injunction in the district court. We've appealed that denial of a preliminary injunction to the U.S. Court of Appeals, asked for and received an accelerated briefing schedule. That appeal is now fully briefed, and we hope will be decided quickly, and we hope that the Fourth Circuit will agree with our Fourth Amendment analysis and issue a preliminary injunction or overturn the district court's denial of the preliminary injunction, and that will halt it. We also have, with help from our national office, engaged in a significant advertising effort here, seeking to raise public awareness of what's going on. We see that reflected in the protests that are happening now, with people specifically calling out this program in the protests that are happening in Baltimore. And we're hopeful, either through the legal process or the political process, that this will be stopped. It's a travesty that it's happening.
Well, we also don't want this spreading to other areas throughout the country.
I think that's a real danger, and why we felt compelled to sue, and why we've opposed it both locally and nationally in every forum.
Unfortunately, our time has come to an end. How can our listeners learn more about your work and the work of the Baltimore ACLU?
Information about this case and all of our other work is on our website, www.aclu-md.org, and on our national office website. Our national office has been leading the litigation effort here, and that's at aclu.org.
David, thank you for all your work on these issues and for being a guest today on Law and Disorder.
Thank you so much for having me on and for your attention to this important issue.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org. Thank you.